this particular act, reporting back not later than February 15, 1973. We feel that the administration and the sponsors of this bill, Mr. Mills, Mr. Cole, Mr. Burns, we feel that we're in a very strong position. Got the bill out with a very substantial majority in the committee. At the same time, there is great concern among the Democratic leadership about the legislation. But we feel that hanging in there pretty strong on this was an issue on which the people are with us. You can hardly find a person around this country that doesn't believe that Uncle Sam ought to be able to struggle along on $250 billion a year in running its financial operation. So, Mr. President, that's my summary of what we are and where we stand.
Question he made about the question. Guy Russell, to realize the progress that we have made, it's really necessary to talk to some foreigners. Remember about a year or so ago, Charlie, we were all stating that fully writing foreigners would not be keeping our own house under the French, British, and German. Why do we do something? Now it's the other way around. All the industrial nations of the world, we have the lowest rate of inflation, the highest rate of growth of the major industrial nations, and the highest increase in real wages of any country in the world. It's higher than Germany, higher than Japan, higher than France, and a lot higher than Britain. Of course, the Italians and the rest are all behind. This is very impressive to the people abroad, particularly impressive to the British. The British are now having all of Western Europe and Japan, the major countries, are having enormous inflationary push. Much of it is due to a wage, quote unquote, it's a wage price push. That is certainly the reason for the British problem. And welfare. In any event, the British are going to come to the hard place over the next 3 months. He will be meeting with the British trade. He is meeting now with the British trade. To see whether they will go along with some sort of voluntary insurance. And they are may bring down the British government. But get what Charles right is that we sometimes tend to, as naturally, to look at the CPI figure every month and say, oh, it went up this month. It's in that terrible. Or the wholesale price index will go up and down and fluctuate. Or we'll see food, which of course is we're either very high or very low, and the last couple of months has been on the upsurge. It's now, if you watch the supermarket, it's begun to come down because the beef box is coming down. The important point that Charlie makes is the one you're not dealing with. But behind all those figures, which vary, is the figure of 1.5%. Or explain exactly what that figure is. That's really part of the
it's non-financial corporation. It's basically the U.S. deals and the automobiles. It's where you have
manufacturing. You see, manufacturing. In other words, you've got a link there. You've got that 1.5%. The others are and your CPI is less than 3 now, looking over the last year. That is the consumer price index, right? It's around 2.9%. Which is bad. So you could roughly say you've cut it in half. But what is really the more impressive line to take, I find, in the talks about it, is to say in all the industrial nations in the world, we have the lowest rate of inflation, the highest rate of growth, and the highest increase in real income of any one of them in the world. So why not continue doing what we're doing? This is not bad. But the danger is, Charlie points out, is that if you go back, that when you have an economy now with a very high rate of growth, then when you have an extraordinary deficit, you have the 68 syndrome will repeat itself. And we're not going to, it won't affect this election, but it'll sure affect the next year and the next election, the off year, right? We could be back in a very heavy inflationary spiral within 18 months. Is that your prediction? Yes, if we have a big deficit. You see, that's why I said a moment ago, when I used the term tax increase, that a responsible administration would have to come in if the Congress rolls the president on this up with an increase in $20 to $25 million over the next 2 or 3 years, but either have to come to the tax increase or accept the fact we're gonna have inflation, right?
Kathy, you wanna elaborate on that a bit more?
Sure, yes. President, gentlemen, we've got a situation which everybody, I think, is familiar, and I just wanted to add a couple of things, and that is that the threats keep continuing. The budget went in at 246. It's already the 250 spending ceiling. We accept the 3.5 increase over that for various things that have happened, including such things as Social Security increase 20% and so on. That's an $18.5 billion increase over the previous fiscal year. So a 250 spending ceiling isn't all that tight, and doesn't provide anything remotely resembling a starvation sort of diet. Furthermore, it does not mean necessarily be cut out. It would simply mean that the rate of growth of a lot of these programs would be slow, because an $18.5 billion increase over a fiscal year is a fair-sized allowance for growth. The other thing is that the spending ceiling is the only way to get hold of what seems to be a situation that is getting out of hand. As the President remarked, with the way the Senate particularly is moving on some of the votes, in the last 3 days, the H.R. 1, the first
of the record show is a meeting only of House members.
Yeah.
You can speak freely.
H.R. 1 in the last 3 days in the Senate, they've added about close to $11 billion in the first 3 budgets. So that it's now $20 billion over the present law.
If I could just say one word on that. I know that the members of the House. The House is always supposed to be liberal, but you're closer to the folks. But anyway, they're probably very concerned because we took quite a meeting last week, Ribbentrop and others, support for Ribbentrop plan, and therefore that's like the welfare reform. Well, assuming it did, we're not going to see that at this point, assuming it did. The Ribbentrop plan would have added 35 million people to the welfare goals over what we are planning. That's why I'm not for any plan that will increase the number of people on welfare above what you propose. So that's the way the issue should be presented in terms of the House. I think most people are not for, they're not granting anybody, let alone the Ribbentrop.
Well, on the
apart from the money part,
yes,
it's the adding the people to the welfare rolls that we oppose, and as that whether it's the Ribbentrop plan or McGovern Plan 1 or McGovern Plan 2 or McGovern Plan 3, every one of them adds people to the welfare rolls.
On the ceiling itself, again, that ceiling was still what Charlie said, offer a $25 billion deficit with a full employment deficit around $3.5 to $4 billion, which is right, we think, at the verge of starting some more inflation, and why it's so necessary to do something about getting hold of it in next year when the economy will bring us to the full steam. And the problem with all of this is, as everybody knows, you've got to start very early to get in position. If we want to make some real effect on 1974, we have to start now. And the spending ceiling is the thing that lets us do it. I don't want them to say anything about this figure publicly, but the simple fact is that if we just let all these programs alone right now and funded them all in 74 at the levels and the rates of increase that they've required in the past, we would have a deficit, an actual deficit, of very close to $39 billion in a full employment situation. And it would be a $20 billion full employment deficit, probably much more than that, probably going much higher as the economy got better, which is completely intolerable if you're in any way worried about inflation. And the problem that a lot of people don't seem to understand is that if you want to get a grip on this, you have to start a good 2 years ahead of time, so that it is, I think, tremendously important that we start now to get ourselves in position, not just to hold the 250 and 73, which we have to do, but to get us in any kind of a position to get a result in 74 where the President can accomplish some of the things he wants to do. Social services is a prime example. Congress is just about to put a social services ceiling. Social services was $190 million in 1963, and we're looking at $5.2 billion this year if we didn't have a ceiling. So ceiling isn't all that revolutionary. Ceiling has been done in a
problem is that the whole budget is very much like social services right now. These spending provisions, the mandatory spending provisions the president spoke about are getting to be somewhat more fashionable, and while we think they're unconstitutional or they're problematic, those are just long court suits, and as you know, there's a court case on highways, and there are mandatory spending provisions with built-in education right now. The politics of the issue is very real, because the government and the Democrats simply want to cut the pension procedures only, and all of these discussions about it work back to that, you can't touch this, and you can't touch that, and you can't touch this. So they're trying to force us in a position where the only cuts that we can make are in the ends, and we want to avoid taxes or inflation. And that would destroy, I think, one of the very best issues that we've got. So the spending ceiling is defeated. Your only real room for reductions, unchallenged, out of court reductions, is in the defense field, where we have already made very substantial reductions. Now, a lot of people are talking about subsidies for the ceiling, and to my great disappointment, Mr. Mayock, who has always told me how strongly he's for the ceiling, is now talking about a congressional veto of each cut, and the simple fact of
lame duck session.
And lame duck session, you know. So the problem is, as you know, that each special interest, if you get an up and down vote on a particular cut, it's going to be able to get enough votes to pass it. The debate then becomes on each item, and you lose this overall consideration. And November 15th is the day to pick. Another of the big arguments that's made is it's an abdication of congressional responsibility. And the simple fact is that that's really
something you don't have.
That's right. That's happened already. That's where we are now, and that's one of the real problems. The ceiling bill simply actually creates a capability, as Charles said, of a new committee that will enable Congress to regain some of the responsibility and capability of preventing this. It's almost impossible under existing procedures, as everybody knows a lot better than I do here, to look at it, at the budget as a whole. And so I don't think that argument holds any water. I disagree with Charles a little bit on the unprecedented delegation of power to the president. I don't think it's that. This was done in 1968. It was done very badly. It was forced on an unwilling president at that time who didn't want to make the tough decisions. And only a courageous president will accept this kind of responsibility. It's only for the fiscal year, remaining 4 or 8 months of the fiscal year. There isn't any real way in which it can be done in any other fashion, because the single individual vote on each item is really where we are now. You can see that with the Senate adding $1 billion a day, as they did last week, the Social Security on each of these items.
What did it do, for example, with that little baby called OEO that they sent down here? Those three or four programs.
Well, the spending we get would enable those to be put back to the level of funding such as zero that some people might recommend. But without it, you have mandatory, so
it will not be a difficult decision.
One other point here. A lot of people seem to be worried, not very many ways, because you have a very fine bipartisan vote there, but some seem to be worried that an attempt to fix some blame on Congress or something of that kind. Actually, there's credit.
Congress has a chance to part from blame. Congress has a chance. I admit, particularly, I was a House member. You've got a chance to go out and say, I voted for a ceiling, and that's a vote against the tax increase. It's a vote against the price increase. It's a vote to keep this damn government from running away. And then, of course, if they pick out any individual program, well, I'm for that. Put up the monkey down the back down here. I'm speaking now. I don't want you folks to look away that far. But the point is that, naturally, is that what you really do, the Congress has got to vote, but you vote for $250 billion ceiling. Then the president decides, well, I'm going to apply it here or there. You say, Congress said, well, I voted for the ceiling, but I didn't want him to apply up there. I want him to apply it over here. Right? It's a Congress either way.
It really is, and you can have a nice academic discussion as to whether it is or isn't an unprecedented delegation of power to the president or anything of that kind. The simple fact is, and I think what the people are going to understand is whether it's a vote for or against taxes, and there is no way with this kind of deficits facing us in the absence of a spending ceiling that you can avoid either inflation, which is a worse form of taxation, or a higher degree of taxation. So you could really send a signal around the world with all of the international taxation, and we can avoid inflation, and we can get hold of the 74 budget.
The latter point is terribly important.
It is, yes, sir.
As we see these numbers escalate, capital sources just don't realize it. One fight at a time. You're looking at the next year, the next year. That's why you take the water bill. People can say, well, it doesn't do too much every year, don't worry about that. When you look at the whole thing, over 3 years, it's $24 billion. There's a lot of bill.
Mr. President, one thing I don't understand is the extent to which this is an either-or proposition. Take the water bill, for instance. That's an authorization bill, but it includes contract authority. But with the debt, with the expenditure ceiling bill, you'd have some lever to control the contract authority. You'd have it for only 1 year, though.
That's right, and it doesn't start till next year. That's control without authority.
Yes, but I'm wondering, to what extent do you say, look at, it will be necessary for you to veto not only this, but other...
I didn't give the unpleasant.
What?
I didn't understand the...
Well, that's what I didn't understand either.
What I'm getting at is this, there are some bills, unfortunately, the water bill is one of them. There are some bills where the expenditure ceiling bill could justify assigning, where you couldn't, if you don't have... In other words, if you have an expenditure ceiling, maybe this doesn't answer, if you've got an expenditure ceiling, then your bill could be affected if the expenditure ceiling comes here. You would not have to be able to say, well, it's an expenditure withhold or whatever the case might be. If it is a bill, it would not be affected by the expenditure ceiling. As many years it has to be vetoed.
What I was hoping was that there was some way in which we could get some leverage for the expenditure ceiling bill by saying that this or that or some other bill will have to be vetoed unless we get the expenditure ceiling
bill. Which one?
I'm interested in the expenditure ceiling bill at this point, but I think that's
what about that point of maximum?
Well, the only point I have about that is that the immediate charge would be made that you're recommending bills to be signed and the money provided for them not going to be spent. So
I think you have to put it in pretty general terms. Well, why is it there are, we can't even indicate, we're not even indicating the water bill that it isn't here yet. Still moving around. But we can't indicate that what's going to happen. I'm simply telling you that given its present form, there's going to be a choice. And I use that as an example because it's a very big one. But there are others where maybe the 250, 300 million, 400 million, 500 million, you might have the second ATW one, is a pretty good point, where they cut it back to 800. Still too much. Why? Veto, right?
Right.
Now, let me say it's much more comfortable to on ACW to veto something there where on substance there's a lot of stuff that ought to be vetoed. The water main is a lot tougher for reasons that I've already mentioned.
Mr. President, could I ask you a question?
Sure.
At this point, I went around and around with Tip O'Neill, who was spouting a very typical and very demagogic Democratic argument that, well, you don't want to give the president this unprecedented power to cut veterans' pensions and to cut vital health services. I know you don't want to spell out precisely where the cuts are going to be made, but is there some way that you can draw off that very specious argument, but still, you know, the general public is listening when they say these things, to emphasize that in abiding by that ceiling that your cuts are not
The only problem with that, Don, is that, of course, when you identify certain areas, why, then it becomes not a vote on the spending ceiling, but a vote on whether you're willing to cut this out of the ones that have been identified. We have identified only those in which we don't plan to make cuts in Social Security and revenue sharing with those two big areas, because those were the ones that were being weakened.
You could add veterans' pensions, yeah.
Well, I realize
it's very hard to go much beyond that. And they'll say, well, what the heck are you going to cut in here? Well, I have some pretty good ideas. We are, a lot of us in HGW, a lot of us in OEO.
A lot of what they're trying to do, I think, with that is first of all, to either to get a particular favorite program set aside so that it won't help. And the other thing is to force us into defense cuts, because after a while you run out of stuff. So they say, well, here's this huge defense machine, cut all that, and then pretty soon we're
back. I think there's one place where it can be very helpful.
and it can be helpful even in some of those areas that you speak about. We have just drew them, it's the cap straight credit design, very, we had a hell of a time making a 4.5% cut in government employees, and all the agencies are squealing and saying, oh, we should cut them and so forth. Walk around this town, go in any agency, go in any local office, see those goddamn federal employees, including the ones here, and they're too many, and we could cut it, it could be cut 10. In other words, this would give us a very great leverage within the bureaucracy, including some of the old line agencies. Right? You can go to interior, you can go to agriculture, you can go to a lot of these others and say, all right, we want a 10% cut in employment in order to help us on the ceiling thing, right, Ken?
You know, 7% cut of employment, we can start very shortly and get us $1 billion next year.
So you're very popular with the public.
Yeah, I see, John, on the cut in employment, they can still do the job. They really can. The cut in employment thing also looking to the future. Incidentally, there's another area you talk about, defense. The uniform personnel is one thing, but the civilian personnel in defense, unless they're too damn many over there,
sure.
Screwing around there at the Pentagon or whatever they do. Treasury. I love it in here. Not IRS. They're supposed to make money. Not customs. Lawyers. Fire lawyers.
All right.
Justice.
No, it doesn't. But the election on the personnel side, our own cabinet officers sit around here. After anybody's been here just a little while, they say, well, gee, old Joe's gonna fire just before Christmas. I got a baby coming. You know, and then down the line, it just all adds up. And when it comes to cutting personnel, it's almost cut. But we have cut 4.5% in the last year. You know, remember, we announced a 5% cut of line 15. You cut 4.5%, right?
Yes, sir.
Right. That has been June 30th, an enormously successful thing. But we want to cut another 5, don't we? Another 7. So
if we can get into that range, it's a way of increasing the productivity of each employee. That's
sure.
And doing the job better. Doing the job better.
It's also, I think that is popular. I mean, if you put it in a general way, I think that is popular. Now, if you say, oh, you're going to cut nurses? No. At the VA? No. And, you know, there are various places that you can't cut IRS agents. I mean, I would say you rather than on the customs area, you're going to have to add 20 on the rail rather than add 5. In other words, you've got to keep the heroin out of the country. But it wouldn't hurt the State Department. I mean, you can't cut many, but they don't have many people abroad. The Defense Department has the CIA. You could cut a third of the CIA out and not miss a damn thing. I never see anything reported by the CIA generally by their people that I can't read in the papers. You know this.
You didn't mention Congress. We might be.
Well, the Congress has got a special problem.
I will get into that.
Let me say, the White House is not really facing my rear, doing fairly well. But we're setting a very good example. I mean, we're rehiring, we're cutting, and so forth and so on. And we have cabinet, you agree, we do a better job with less people.
Yes.
We work better with almost everybody. This personnel thing, because I think it's one of the most important things in terms of not only it, sure, it's, you talk, that's only $1 billion, but in terms of getting the government to do a better job, slimming it down, believe me, start cutting personnel. I find in a campaign, my own piece, I find when you've got less people, with more responsibility to do, you do a hell of a lot better job. You've got just loads of money and people running around, everybody getting everybody's way. The same way is true of government.
Where are we on procedure? Votes on this?
Well, that comes now 10 minutes ago.
That's the best. Mr. President, there's another argument that the members might use that the President recommended the $465 billion limit extension and linked with a 250 ceiling on spending. If they reject the $250 billion spending, the chances are that we've got to get a higher debt ceiling. The $265 is not sufficient then.
No question.
And I think that point can be made to the members, conservatives particularly on the floor, that if they don't keep this debt at that level, they've got to go with the 250 spending ceiling.
Why don't you go over the procedures now?
Yes, so the Wilbur Mills and the committee carried out the bill and request a close rule. And the Speaker and Hale Boggs and George Mahon and the subcommittee chairman of appropriations and the Democratic Regional Whips
united to pressure the Rules Committee, and it appears now that there will be a rule given probably tomorrow, which will permit one substitute on the floor, probably offered by George Mahon, which will give the President a $250 billion ceiling, but require him to report back on November the 15th a list of cuts, and presumably would give the Congress 30 days to veto that package of cuts.
November 15th being right in the middle of the plane cuts.
Yeah.
Veto any of the cuts or the whole cut?
We have seen it, Judge, but we
one by sort of, it gives the Congress what the President of a high veto, and it would be that.
Which, of course, they're against. So, it seems to me that we have to defeat the Mahon substitute and then pass the committee bill. And that would be very, very difficult, I think, with all the pressure that is mounting against it. Now, there's some things I believe this group can do. Mr. Aaron, you might put a whip check out if you can. Assuming they'll be on the floor probably Wednesday.
It'll be on the floor Wednesday.
I think if you could do rule tomorrow, it's probably be Wednesday. Maybe Thursday.
Right here. Voting plan.
Probably Wednesday afternoon.
Voting Wednesday.
Yeah.
Well, that's right. It's the House.
So if you get a vote check and see if we, how many votes we have. I think we have to get 160 Republicans and probably 50 Democrats to carry the day.
Who started that?
Jerry Ford indicated he thought he could get that many, and Wilbur Hill feels he'd get 50 Democrats. So.
Wilbur stayed in bed?
Yes.
Yes, sir.
Mark. That's what you understand. That's
good.
So that'd be very helpful, I think. Yeah. And John, is there any chance of your policy committee acting tomorrow, maybe?
Yes, sir.
And circulate the decision. That kind of makes a party loyalty thing, I believe. When the policy committee
should be party loyalty on this. Look at this. Lead out here. Johnson did one
That's really what people really see in those terms, rather than spending. It's really, look, fellas, what do you want to do? You want to go down the road and take responsibility for raising taxes or higher prices. That's what they're doing.
Joe, we've got 138 co-sponsors, as you know right now, on this spending legislation.
Oh, yeah.
Some of these people may have forgotten they sponsored that darn thing.
They'll be reminded.
You have a conference, John, on Wednesday, I believe, with Herb Stein.
Yeah.
Could we maybe double up the cap?
That could be an excellent opportunity. Stein, why don't we shift? Stein, yeah, the numbers are darn good, and you ought to hear him. He's terrific. I think he'd be good. Same as what to it. Lay it off.
Okay. Maybe we can put him in on that.
Where's the sun standing?
Well, they're waiting for the house back, of course. Next week.
Where's that? Let us make a young stand on that.
I think he's with us.
Are you sure?
He co-sponsored last year.
And we just talked here right in the room about the Senate and what is going to happen. At the present time, many of you well know the chances of the Senate taking action would not be considered to be too good. On the other hand, it also, if the House should act, and the House should, it would have a very good effect down here in terms of the veto strategy. As you see, it would have a very good effect down here in terms of withholding. You know what I mean? You have to make a tough choice if the House is acting. Right, Cap? Get on some of these legal things. You say, well, the sense of the Congress or the House has already been expressed. As far as Senate is concerned, I think they need to get over there. And then we'll start putting the beat in that. And let's face it, what we are really doing here is also making a political issue. There's a lot of talk about who's going to raise taxes, right? Or indirect. And we're making the political issue by putting the money on their back. That's another reason why the party loyalty is so important. If the Republicans en masse vote for this, then it isn't the Congress that is exceeding the
president's budget or refusing to put a ceiling on, it is the Democratic leadership of the Congress. The Democratic. You've got to separate this Congress out. That's why the Republicans can go. I mean, I don't, if you really come down to a cold turkey and if we, it becomes pretty much a party vote, that's all right, too. So be it. And if Mansfield, Senate leadership, want to make it a party issue the other way, then they have to take the responsibility for that kind of responsible program.
We have notified all the surrogates who are out speaking this week, but this is on the front burner. It's the number one issue for this week. So our people that are moving around the country can present us some support. And also the Congressional Campaign Committee has been teletyped out to their congressional candidates.
But I also say one thing. I think Smitty is raising another point that less cherry involved or some rest of us. Why is it the House always has to go first on tough things when the Senate dogs it? This is one of those spaces where I think voting for this ceiling is a plus issue for the guys that vote for it. I don't think it's a negative issue. Depends, I guess, on how you present it. But the fact that you vote for it, the Senate drags its feet. At least you, everybody that votes for this is voting for fiscal responsibility for the family. Voting against tax increase, voting against price increase is a good issue, I think.
Is it less? No question.
I don't know whether
all over Illinois, you people are kooky up there.
Yes. Mr. President, it'll help us with the vetoes, too, because it's emphasizing the fact that that we're in trouble fiscally.
Right.
And you're going to be asking us to support you on some vetoes later this year. And
most of the tough ones get here.
Yes, but if we've had a big push on
right.
an expenditure ceiling, why it's got people thinking about
right.
the fiscal matter.
Right. Mr. President, there jurisdictional overtones between the Ways and Means and Appropriations Committee kind of permitting this thing, and maybe if Mr.
Well, that's going on for some time, of course. And George Mahon got on me when I introduced the bill. I was interested the other day that Lou Deschler came to me. He said, Frank, are you going to permit the Ways and Means to invade your committee jurisdiction? The answer to Lou was that there was no other way to get things under control when you let the Ways and Means come in. So they've got everybody working, including Lou.
Well, if the Republicans only
got the race motion, they take back.
I thought he was supposed to play it in the middle.
He's supposed to be
the president.
The
Crown Brady
hasn't been lately.
No. As president, the Republican platform calls for a legislative ceiling on the spending to be enacted this year. So. And also, Frank, you know, the last time we had a meeting, the Appropriations Committee, some of us let George know that we were all pleased with the fact that the Appropriations Committee has never done anything to put any ceiling, any overall ceiling on spending.
George has absolutely denied me the right to even bring up an amendment which would put on a ceiling. I want to do it on the continuing resolution.
No,
you denied that right to deliver.
I went out to see him about 4 weeks ago and asked him if there was any desire on his part that this originate in appropriations rather than waste meat, because he always told me that he favored the idea. He said he could get no one on his committee who would pick it up. Nobody was interested in it on his committee. I knew you'd introduce the bill, so I didn't argue with it. But so I said, again, we're going to get caught in any jurisdictional crossfire here. And he said, no, not as far as I'm concerned. I'll help you with it. So I've been a little disappointed, as I said.
I'm glad to be disappointed.
Go ahead. Mr. President, we're also trying to stimulate the outside groups that have an interest in this, the segments along the bankers, insurance, Chamber of Commerce, and hopefully they're working. I don't know how effective they'll be, but they are interested, and they're trying to send print wires and buttonhole numbers. So we have that kind of working in the background of all this. And of course, those of us in the White House and the Treasury are happy to work with you on speeches or any support material that you need for the next couple
of years. We will consider any action from here that we feel would be helpful. It's always a question.
The argument from the liberals continues to be that it's a line item, beat item, and I know that your position is not that.
It isn't that really, because it isn't even close to that, because none of this vetoes out a program. It leaves the program on the statute books,
right.
And it funds most of them probably at a level of in excess of the previous year, and it only lasts until June 30th of next year. So that you have all these major differences, and item veto just keeps the program completely off the statute books. this doesn't interfere with any authorizations or anything of that kind. It just says we can't grow at the kind of rate we've been growing or we've been talking about growing and still avoid taxation.
Does that answer the item veto on appropriations, sir?
Yes.
One compromise that some of them have suggested is that no program be reduced less than 10% or something of that sort.
Well, will you address yourself?
I think there are two things wrong with that, Barbara. One is that in the way things have been going, I don't think it's enough. And in the other situation is that it means that you would have to reach 10% of practically every program, including such things as Social Security and revenue sharing, which we don't want to do. We don't think
we'll see, look, some things shouldn't be, frankly, well, it's a line item. Some things shouldn't be decreased at all. And other things could be certainly decreased 25%. Nothing is going to be knocked out. The line item vetoes, I understand, and I've never served in the city legislature, right? Here, you just reduce things certain amount, but it's got to be varied depending upon. You can't reduce the number of nurses in a veterans hospital, right? You can't reduce the customs guards, but there are certainly personnel areas you can consider. It's across the board 10% in order to get to 7.5.
It isn't really such an unprecedented thing because, as I say, the Congress made it the price of the surtax in 1968, as you know. And the President Johnson didn't want it and fought against it. But that was only, it was done very badly because there were so many basic exceptions to it. I think it's just a straight academic point as can be argued, but the basic question is, do you want more taxes? And a vote for this ceiling is a vote against taxes.
But to ask Franklin's question, is George politically, and also politically motivated by you and now?
Yeah.
But he made a great speech.
Would you agree, John?
I don't know whether he's politically motivated or whether he has some vague idea of protecting the jurisdiction of the committee. Anyway, it's
gone beyond that.
He may be, Frank.
I begged him to pick it up himself and start it in that committee about 4 weeks ago.
Yeah. We've all begged you to do it, yeah, whatever. But
one last thing, Mr. President, is that if we should lose the Mahon substitute, I suppose that John Burns will have another shot at recommittal to vote on the 250 committee ceiling. If the Mahon substitute should carry, then the next shot would be a recommittal motion.
No, because no, we can't do that. Well, it's an amendment. You can't attack it by a motion to recommit. Well, you can have a separate vote on it. You can have another vote on the amendment.
Substitute.
You can have a separate vote on the amendment.
Separate vote on the amendment.
Which is good, Bill.
You can have a separate vote on the amendment. Which then you can gear your motion to recommit, but you also have to add the amendment. And you'll never be able to get rid of it, but it's got the Mahon amendment, you might just as well not have title to it all, fundamentally, because that's truly an item veto.
Well, it offers a lot of expectation.
It doesn't give the President any authority to operate on the basis of changing situations. You may decide today that you're going to cut in a certain area that 4 months from now you decide that maybe you ought to relax that.
That's exactly right.
Prove it. But you just freeze it under those circumstances, which it seems to me is the bad part of the Mahon thing, in addition to the idea that what the hell Congress is, you know, they're going to disapprove.
Sure.
Oh, that's your opinion.
I frankly don't have much faith in that, certainly.
Go ahead.
It'd be a very tough vote, but I think if we maximize our Republicans, I think you can end that really long.
Bill, and your nose got on this, unless I think it's important to touch on this. We're getting into a period of absenteeism, maybe a very important thing. The election is 5 weeks from tomorrow, and a lot of guys are back at the hustings, or ought to be. And we may have some problem about who's going to be here.
That's why the book check's so important, I think.
Yeah, yeah, well, if they're not here tomorrow, they're never going to be here.
We'll be here tomorrow, but
we get them with everything we have, and we're going to catch them again today. They're not here tomorrow because of the vote. We'll never get them. Get them tomorrow.
We'll keep them. It's going to be rather hard lesson. Any more votes? No. Election. Next.
Well, I'm going to say, they're doing nothing too bad.
Our calls, yeah.
I don't know.
Mr. President, if we are able to succeed with this, we aren't going to turn around and accept a major, expensive Social Security package, are we? Kind of worried about what's happening in the Senate. And there's a feeling that you can't, under any circumstances, stand up against Social Security. But, my Lord, we're talking about probably an $8-10 billion package. What I understand they're doing there, they've reduced the retirement age to 60 and 55 for widows.
$20 billion under the present law as of Saturday night.
Is that what the prognosis on that?
What's going to happen? Well, I don't know what will happen in the conference. Presumably, they'll get the four titles off the floor and into conference and come up with something lower. But the problem is that the 20% increase earlier in the year has eaten up a great deal, practically all of that now, unless you have gigantic payroll tax increases.
Even that
will finance a $20 billion package. So you have to go into general revenue, and that means forcing a tax increase again.
That would be fiscally very disastrous.
Yes, sir. Mm-hmm.
That was a beautiful article. That was a good article in the Post yesterday, that complete full page thing about Social Security. Anyone take time to read it, then they begin to understand. A couple of average taxpayers never read this kind of thing. What the act looks like. It's amazing.
Well, don't you think they're trying to force the president to veto that bill?
Sure.
As much as that, Social Security is completely political, yes.
That was 54 votes in the Senate, yes. Just barely over one half.
Education in people in California talking about 25% limitation on any of our program. That's what they're calling everybody in. Is that a really assumption? Yeah. So to go one program to be more than 25
years. Well, that now, today, as well as I'm going to say something.
Yes, sir. We thought maybe that John Ehrlichman and Kent Weinberger would go out to the press and with the Mucci's, and maybe that the leaders could follow up on the Hill with statements how important this is, voting against the Senate, vote for higher taxes, and start building up some
bill. Let me suggest to the leadership here how that Jerry said he'd try to be back here between 12 and 1 o'clock. So I suggest that we might whip off the right off the floor with Jerry here at 1:30. We'll all come over at 1:30. Jerry's here. Let's get our heads together and start here. So if you come to tonight, you know, I'm crazy. Still, you come to
let us know.
Yes. Yes.
Well, we appreciate you coming down on Monday morning. I think when I said Monday, I knew that you were meeting with a group of Democratic leadership. You never get them here. Republicans are always here. Okay.
Well, we wish you well. We wish that Social Security, though, has been out there as broad as on earth. I mean, to send that thing down half of 20%,
go by, they know you can't do it. 20% was pretty bad.
It was 20%
of the sign? No, and no committee of the Congress had considered it.
Now, this one is, I guess,
Well, they create an expectancy, too.
Everybody's sure.
Nobody's got the check for the last one yet. It's coming out today.
A little note.
Well, we wish you well. We wish that Social Security, though, is the goddamn fraud is on our. I mean, to send that thing down after 20%, they know you can't do it. 20% was pretty bad, too.